All right. Well, I'm joined today with Hillary Leiterman, who is the Associate Director of Residence Life at the University of South Carolina. That's the Gamecocks, right?
That's right.
Okay. All right. The Gamecocks. And Hillary and I have known each other for a while. We did our undergrad together at Marquette University, and then she moved on to Ball State. And she has become an expert in the curricular approach in residential life and housing. She has 16 years of progressive experience. Her dissertation was on the organizational perspective on implementing the residential curriculum approach, an ethnographic case study. A lot of words.
Could have really gone a little more succinct on that, but
yeah. It's good. It tells you exactly what you're getting into. And you've been a keynote speaker at the Institute on the curriculum approach, which has changed its name, I think, over
time. Yes, I've been on faculty since 2012. So
wow.
Residential Curriculum Institute, and then in 2018, so the Institute on the Curricular Approach to broaden more to divisions and other functional units.
Right. And it started fairly small, right? The first institute was probably like, what, 40-ish people? And now I think people are getting turned away because there's not enough capacity for the level of interest, which is really cool.
Yes. The mentors and folks like Kathleen Kerr and Jim Tweedy, who told me about, you know, staff members, colleagues in a hotel room scribbling the 10 essential elements on a napkin saying, what could this look like? And, you know, they've been shaped and massaged over time. And now I think the Institute, there's a wait list usually of about 150 schools, and, you know, which is a very hard balance of everyone should come and we want everyone to come, but then how do you practice good pedagogy when there are 2,000 people?
So. Yeah, absolutely. But it's crazy. And then there's a book coming out this summer, I think Keith was telling me.
It's a book, yeah. Through
are you part of that too?
I am.
I can't wait to get that my hands on that. So that's awesome.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
It was just showed up in the last stylus. And I got that in the mail and said, what? But definitely look up to the other more experienced individuals on that project.
Oh, no, that's incredible. I'm sure everybody brought something different to enhance what the end product is. So that's really cool.
Thank you.
So Hillary, how did you get interested in the curricular approach? How did that come across your world and you got so passionate about it and engaged in it? How did that happen for you?
Yeah, well, it's actually kind of funny. It started as a pretty serious job requirement. So I was a month into my associate director role here, and our executive director said, hey, I need you to come to my office. I said, oh my gosh, I've only been here a month. And she left. This was Dr. Kirsten Kennedy, and said, hey, this curricular approach in student affairs and namely in housing and residence life is really a thing. It's really important. My eye is on this as an emergent trend. So I've already signed you up, and you and two other colleagues are going to go to this institute. And her words, the parting words were, I want you to go learn everything you can and lead us on the path of the most excellent residential curriculum. So it started that way. It's been quite a journey. I give all the credit, kudos, and appreciation to every staff member who's been through the doors here, because it's our work together. Mm-hmm. And I was transitioning to learning how to be an associate director at that time while trying to lead this massive effort in an aggregate fashion for 8,000 students. So it's been a good journey. And then that opened the opportunity where I was meeting and networking with others doing this work, which is, I think, how I fell into us hosting. Mm-hmm. I went through my whole PhD program stumbling, not having a dissertation topic, feeling so frustrated, and then finally hitting me and talking with Keith Edwards and Kathleen Kerr and saying, I think this is what it is. And they said, yeah, I think you're overthinking it. Go talk to your chair. So that's a little bit in a snapshot how it all came to be.
Wow, incredible. So for folks that are not as familiar with the curricular approach, how would you describe the teaching and learning of curriculum in residence life or student affairs? What does that look like?
Yeah, I would say in a nutshell, it's being very clear as a campus about what is valued for the students on that campus. We all have some similar website language. We've all had access to different books and graduate programs and mentors. But for me, the curricular approach really starts with clarity on that institutional landscape. What our students here need would be very different than on your campus, than on our friends' campuses. And so it's that clarity that then creates very clear learning outcomes that then get operationalized through strategies or learning platforms, which could be in person, online, whatever the case might be. But I think the key part of the curricular approach and what makes it different is that continuity and that flow that comes from the clarity of the outcomes all the way through the execution and the assessment. And that in previous models, it was perhaps a little less clear. There were some staff preferences at play. There were institutional norms or just efficiency in some way. And I think that the teaching and learning now is deeper and gives a much better nod and recognition to K through 12 learning and teaching and the importance of higher education and beyond the classroom staff taking that seriously and embracing that in educator role versus an administrative transactional arena.
Great. Thank you. So you mentioned assessment. How do you know if the curriculum is leading to student learning?
Yeah, tricky. I think I always say to our staff that we have to think about this piece every day, and we need to sit in the ambiguity and the discomfort, because from my personal opinion, I don't know that any of us in higher education or student affairs have identified the way. I think there are brilliant minds who have put forth models and algorithms and platforms, but none of us, to my opinion, have nailed it. So I think it comes back to assessing from institutional norms and culture. So I think many campuses would focus on students' sense of belonging first. Mm-hmm. I think we want very much to say students are learning beyond the classroom. I don't know why we wouldn't want that. Of course we do. But I think we sometimes get ahead of ourselves and have to think about students' sense of belonging and mattering and transition before mm-hmm. and get to higher order learning. So thinking about Maslow's, and sometimes, you know, my colleagues have to challenge me. Are we getting too aspirational with our first year students? Doesn't mean we don't love them or care about them, right. But we created enough in gauging their self sense of mattering, of, you know, attending, being able to resolve conflicts and, you know, through their words and their language. Retention, of course, is huge. I think that there is no way around acknowledging that if our students don't stay with us or progress and move forward, that we're not doing it right.
Sure.
Oh, hello. Cut out.
I think that's a huge part of the curricular approach and trying to, like I said, we haven't nailed any, you know, perfect strategy, but I think being able to gauge how are students learning specific skills in a residential setting, for example, whether that is interpersonal communication, whether that is conflict. I don't believe that we should be using rubrics on an individual student level. Like I should never be grading you as a staff. But I think that we could use rubrics in the aggregate to shape the tools, the lesson plans, the, you know, the execution means, if you will, to be clear on, you know, what are we aiming towards? I think the last point I'll make on that is I think theory comes into play. So just for example, a very common theory used on a lot of campuses is Baxter McGolda's work on self-authorship. So I think it's always important, whether it's that or Kolb's model of experiential learning, whatever have you, that show up in the assessment space to say, if this is where we're beginning and these are the glasses we're putting on to look through and design, are we also keeping those on when we're thinking about those assessment variables and metrics?
Right. Awesome. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So thinking about developing glasses and training your staff, which we talked about a little bit before we started recording. But how do you, what kind of systems and structures does a department need to have so that their frontline educators are able to implement curriculum?
Yes. I would say I had a hard time not interrupting and just saying this because it's the first thing I want to say. It needs to be embedded in the culture as a priority. Mm-hmm. Time is the biggest, first answer to your question. Being able to foster a learning organization, which again, I think there's so much out there. There are books, there are speakers, there are all kinds of pieces out there beyond student affairs about learning organizations. Mm-hmm. But that, just like I was saying in the first question, that we need to be clear about our campus and our fabric and what makes this unique at USC, for example, I think the same for this question. So thinking about how do we prioritize the work that we're doing, not only with staff training, but with budget alignment, with, you know, our staff position descriptions, the interview process. I think with training, we've shifted away over time from making this a topic to curricular approach to making it a framework for training. So talking about the curricular approach as much as possible in the way that it plays out in the organization. So on day one, really focusing on the why USC, why this philosophy and approach. And then as the days go on, what does this have to do with crisis and conduct meetings, and why is this still our lens for working with campus partners, or what does this have to do for advising? So we've really tried to massage over time, speeding up our staff's learning curve. In the past, we would send all of our new professionals to the National Institute in October, but we were resting on our laurels and saying, well, gosh, they'll get it when they go. Well, July to October is, you know, when we talk about first impressions with students, we needed to give the right tools in July and August.
Sure. Oh, that makes sense. So with that, and thinking about, I know when we were implementing at UCF, one of our assessment pieces was going back to the resident assistants and the graduate assistants and the folks that were helping to facilitate and implement and getting their feedback as well. But how do you know when something's not working, when you're not meeting your learning objectives or students are not engaging in whatever the approach is? How do you know that's not working, and what's your process in terms of addressing that and readjusting?
I think that's a great question. Usually, while I didn't like to admit it at first, it comes through the staff of this is not working. And, you know, I'll say in my earlier days with this work, I colleagues that, again, helped me learn and grow into a different scope of my role to say, it's not that we're not trying, it's not that we're not, you know, executing, here's what we're seeing. So I have learned the importance of listening, assuming, and of course letting the data speak, because conversations were different when there was nothing submitted. We would do like a live time, so say you executed a lesson plan last week, the following week we would have you fill out kind of a Google form, a short couple questions, how did it go, what would we tweak? So for me, that was a big point when staff were not submitting that. And then, you know, being able to hear, well, and implement it, because our students aren't going to connect with that. So I think being able to get the ego away, I'm sure other folks have talked with you about that, stepping away from, I know this can work and I want this to work and this is important to what do we need to do to pivot and adjust. So I think that's important. And I also think, you know, we're on our fourth revision of the curriculum. Maybe in January, I was told by our leadership, hey, we've had a lot of institutional leadership, divisional leadership changes, departmental leadership changes. The curricular work has been similar, but a little bit different, you know, pretty similar for 10 years. Your charge is to blow it out of the water. We want it to look nothing like it does now. Not that it's bad, but you should start over and create it with these Gen Z students in mind, new presidential leadership within a year. And it's made a lot of sense. I was like, yeah, I think I'm doing educational malpractice, or we would be if we didn't do that. So I was like, thank you. That's the green light I needed. So that's been helpful too.
I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, I work with clubs and organizations and student leadership, and I have said we can't present the same thing every orientation or every leadership training, because the students are different. They have different needs. We have to, like you said, get to know them, build the foundation, get the belonging, and then figure out, you know, how to meet them where they are and get them what they need. And it may be we don't move them all the way through that development chain, and that's okay. But kind of accepting that, and I think also letting go of perfection. It's never going to happen.
Yeah, I love that. I really need to remind myself of that. And it doesn't matter what other schools are doing or did last year. It matters for, can we sleep at night knowing we're doing the best we can by these students?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. That puts it right in the present, very relevant present moment. Yes.
Yeah.
So Hillary, we have a few minutes left. So my last question is really thinking about, the curricular approach. It's a trend, and it's been a trend for the last 13 years, right? But it hasn't caught on everywhere. So if you were going to sell it to somebody, what would you tell them why should you pick this up if it's, you know,
I think
that it takes work, it takes training.
That's the best question. For me, I think the approach, the philosophy behind it, as well as the pragmatic execution, keeps student affairs relevant in higher education and keeps student affairs professionals as educators who serve a purpose in the lives of students, because students are not bifurcated robots who turn themselves on and off and wind down and wind up when they go to an academic building versus anywhere else on campus. So that relevancy and that contributing to value added in development, in mattering, in sense of belonging, but also application. So being able to, in a quote unquote safer space before graduating or moving off campus or moving wherever, to be able to practice and apply skills and competencies and attitudes at that next layer of developmental life. So that's how I would sell it.
Great. Sold.
That's such a good question.
Sold. Well, I imagine you don't necessarily have to sell it, because the professionals that you're seeing at institutes have already bought in enough to, you know, come to an institute or, and you're on campus that was already buying in. So it was just kind of creating that culture. So that's kind of,
yeah.
I think my campus, although we are much smaller and we have a much smaller residential life, we're moving that direction. Moving to living learning communities and residential curriculum. And it's a slow move, but I think we're going to get there in the next year or two. So that's kind of exciting. All right.
Multiple campuses. You study it. You've lived it. They're lucky to have you.
Thank you. That's nice of you to say. So we'll see.